And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
The race is on, and Ferrari ended Formula One pre-season testing with a 1-2 courtesy of Carlos Sainz and Charles Leclerc. But nobody is buying Red Bull being 3/4 of a second behind, as the timesheets suggest. I'm Ed Straw, and joining us with all the answers are Scott Mitchell-Malne and Samarth Kanal, with Mark Hughes and Gary Anderson also joining in. Well, Scott, it feels like just seconds ago testing was kicking off here, yet it also feels like we've been here for an entire lifetime.
Yeah, it's just the paradox that we have of F1 testing, I think, where there are where you look ahead to it and you think, oh God, these are three really, really long days coming up. But then at the same time, you have those 3 days pass in the blink of an eye. It's a little bit like an F1 Bermuda Triangle, really, where you just... time loses all sense and place loses all sense as well. And it's a strange reality. But I do love F1 testing, because no matter how many years you do it for and how many times you go away and you run through broadly a similar process over however many days and whatever track you go to, it's always fun. It doesn't feel as repetitive as it should feel. I find it entertaining. I find it hard work, but I do find it rewarding and it's an enjoyable challenge.
And talking of the challenge of testing, Samarth, this is your first pre-season testing with the race, and it's your second podcast appearance. We've let you back on after yesterday. So how's it for you?
I'm grateful you let me back on. And it's been great. Yeah, it has been a bit of a blur. So many interesting things. It's hard to pick out a pecking order on the Red Bull, but I have a rough idea about it. And I guess it's an old cliche, though, isn't it? It's only testing, or it is testing, and you can't glean too much from the results. Or can you? I don't know. Can you glean too much from the results?
Well, not too much. Not too much.
You can glean stuff, though, because if we couldn't glean anything, we just have to end the podcast now, which wouldn't be great value for money.
And so, yeah, that's the end of the Race F1 podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
So, Scott, we can talk about what's going on.
Yes.
We haven't changed our opinion that Red Bull is favourites.
No.
However, Ferrari is looking interesting, would you say?
Definitely interesting. I think what Ferrari cemented on the final day was its emphatic place as best of the rest. So I think for most of the first couple of days, we were agonising a little bit over who would be in that role, because there did seem to be a cluster of teams, not in no particular order, Ferrari, McLaren, Mercedes, Aston Martin. You'd even hear RB mentioned a little bit in connection with that group, albeit at the back of it. But then by the end of day two, the Ferrari did look quite good, not just one lap pace that topped the times, but the long run pace in particular, a race run, caught the eye. And then through all of day three, all it's done is really, really, like I say, cement that position. I think I don't believe it's going to challenge Red Bull, let alone beat Red Bull next week. I do fear what some people in the paddock are saying inside the teams and other observers I've spoken to, that Red Bull could be even further ahead than last year, which scares the crap out of me, to be honest. But I can't help but be a bit optimistic. What I've seen from the Ferrari just makes me think maybe if it's best of the rest, can it be a good best of the rest and snipe at the Red Bull? It certainly passed the eye test as far as I was concerned trackside.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll get back onto that in a moment. But shall we hear Mark Hughes, who has been stuck in his bunker for a third consecutive day analysing every single lap time. So here's what he makes of the running in Bahrain.
So, on the final day of pre-season testing, Max Verstappen was only fourth in the headline numbers with a 130.755, set early in the afternoon on a set of C3 tyres which had already done an attack lap. So realistically, that's the equivalent of a 1:30.5 on a fresh set. The three cars ahead of the Red Bull in the headline times, Ferrari, the Mercedes, and a literally last lap flying Sauber, all the dead times on the C4 tyre, which is around 6/10 quicker than the C3. So theoretically, correcting everyone to fresh C3s, and bearing in mind that Verstappen's time came around 4 p.m. with the track at an unhelpfully hot 34 degrees, which was about 6 degrees hotter than the later times were set, his Red Bull appeared to have a real advantage of around 4/10 of Charles Leclerc's Ferrari and George Russell's Mercedes over a single lap. Now, the Ferrari's pace has been evident throughout the 3 days of testing, whereas that of the Mercedes was only extracted late on the final day. And furthermore, Mercedes didn't get to do a race simulation, as it devoted its time to relatively short runs assessing test items. So we don't have a full picture on just exactly where Mercedes stands. But even discounting the C4 rubber Russell used to set that second fastest time, his time on the C3s a little bit earlier tallies closely with that of Leclerc's. They were set a little bit earlier still, when the track was around 3 degrees hotter, and so probably a bit slower. So probably the Ferrari shades the Mercedes over a lap based on what we saw, but as ever, we don't know the base fuel weights. The fact that no one approached Carlos Sainz's C4 shot, 129.9, from yesterday, suggests the track may have been slower on the final day. Correcting for his tyres yesterday, Sainz shaded Sergio Perez by around a tenth. Today, again correcting tyres, Leclerc was shaded by Verstappen by 4/10. So it really does look as though Red Bull has a very handy advantage over one lap, despite what we saw yesterday. If we take Verstappen's theoretical fresh tyred 130.5 on the C3s as a baseline, we get the following approximate order of one lap pace. We get Red Bull at the front, plus a 4/10 gap to Ferrari and Mercedes, then another 10th to McLaren, another 10th to Aston Martin, a 3/10 gap then to RB and Williams, and then a further 1/10 gap to Sauber, Alpine and Haas. Sauber did what it did here a couple of years ago and produced a last lap flyer on the softest tyre, and presumably without even the base weight of fuel that we'd been carrying up to that point, giving Zhou Guanyu the third fastest time. But everything the Sauber had done up until that moment suggests it's in a very tight tail end group, with RB, Williams, Alpine and Haas in that order. The picture changes slightly when looking at the available race simulations. Red Bull, Aston Martin, McLaren, Williams, RB, Sauber and Haas all completed 3-stint race simulations of some sort. Ferrari appeared to do only the first 2 stints and a partial third before the session ended, and neither Mercedes nor Alpine attempted a simulation. So Verstappen completed the fastest full race sim, way more competitive than that recorded yesterday by Sergio Perez, who seemed to be carrying a problem. He's so far off. But in the 2 stints completed by Leclerc today, he was nip and tuck as quick as Verstappen. We just don't have the full validation of him completing that third stint to know for sure. But team boss Frederic Vasseur acknowledged that tyre degradation was on a different planet, better than that of a year ago. And it seems as if the new Ferrari may have given away some one-lap pace to Red Bull in exchange for some race pace compared to last year. In all, it's been a highly encouraging 3 days for the Scuderia. Aston Martin's race sim was somewhat truncated and a long way from the full 57-lap race distance, but Fernando Alonso did complete 3 stints. Assuming equal fueling, his pace suggested that the Aston would finish around 16 seconds behind the Red Bull over the 57-lap race distance, and probably behind Ferrari 2 with the Mercedes, an unknown dark horse. Although the McLaren appeared to ace the Aston over a lap, its race simulation was nowhere near as good. Oscar Piastri struggling with heavy degradation of both the C3 and C1 compounds. Piastri's race sim was in fact slower than the Williams of Alex Albon, and roughly on a par with Daniel Ricciardo's RB. The Haas was a solid last in the race sim, almost half a minute adrift of RB, with Guanyu Sauber in between. And that's how it was poised at the end of 3 days of testing. Some of the gaps are small enough to make the order somewhat volatile. So it's quite an intriguing situation ahead of next week's Bahrain Grand Prix.
As always, thanks very much, Mark, for that insight. So, Samarth, I guess the question is, if, as the numbers suggest, Red Bull is ahead by a few tenths, does Ferrari have a car it can work with, a platform it can develop and maybe do something about Red Bull with?
I think it's been a really promising... The last 2 days especially have been really promising. I think day one is always a bit of an unknown generally, because there's lots of procedural stuff, things that can go wrong, and it's your first day of testing. And I'm not saying ignore it, but the last couple of days have been really good for Ferrari. you know, a solid benchmark. And their long run pace is what looks really good. A really interesting car design. I don't think they'll beat Red Bull in the first race. I don't want to, you know, shoot for that, but I think they have a good platform on which to build on.
And hopefully as well, a car that if Red Bull underachieve a little bit on a weekend, they could do something with it. But the interesting thing is that the car is more stable aerodynamically, more drivable, more drivability, as Charles Leclerc says. And when he says that, he doesn't actually mean literal drivability like we might think in terms of power delivery and that kind of thing. He just means about user-friendliness and predictability and consistency. And that was the really positive thing, because not only does that mean it's a better car to drive, Scott, but it also means it won't work the tyre so hard. So there's the hope that this offset we saw in performance, with Ferrari being very quick in qualifying and not so quick in the race, hopefully won't be such a problem.
Yeah, we heard so many times last year, and actually I think probably even before 2023, back in 2022 as well, from Ferrari, this idea that if it was quick enough, then it would be quick enough in over one lap and the race, and that the reason it didn't munch its tyres particularly, it was just because it wasn't quite as fast in the race, it had to push harder to be able to run at the pace that it needed to fight the people around it. That would overwork the tyres and it would drop back. I mean, there's some merit to it, but I think it's a bit more complicated than that. Ultimately, the best car you have, the better it looks after the tyres, as well as being quicker and enable you to look after the tyres. So if it has got on top of that, it would be a huge win. But I agree with you with what we could see trackside, that consistency. It just spoke to a few things being better, didn't it? Aerodynamically, it seemed to be performing more consistently. The drivers were a lot happier about how the car does what they want it to do and need it to do. And that was really apparent trackside. I went out my favourite place, turn 10, looking back at the entry from turn 9 into turn 10. And I saw Carlos Sainz do a long run in the morning, and I saw Charles Leclerc do a long run in the evening. And hardly any missteps across both of them. There was one lockup for Sainz, but I think he just got the entry wrong on that occasion. The rest of that run was really good, and the Leclerc run in the evening, there was one almost like micro correction I saw him have to make where the front didn't quite get into the apex. This was in sort of like 2/3 of the way into the run as I saw it, and I thought there might be like a hint of some understeer creeping into the car as the tyres go away and it starts to fade. Next lap, bang, just right on the apex, kissing the inside curb really nicely, and did that in the subsequent laps as well. So it brought it back under control. It showed that there wasn't something inherently wrong with the car, and it just faded as the stint went on. And it just made the strongest impression of any car other than the Red Bull trackside. I would go so far as to say, not that it looked quicker on the hardest compounds than others looked on softer compounds, but it made a better impression. It looked better on the C1 tyre, for example, than the impression the Mercedes left, for example, when it came through on the C4. The Mercedes didn't do anything on the softest compound tyre that I saw it run that made me go, oh, wow, that looks incredible, in the way that the Ferrari made me go, this is just a really nicely poised racing car.
And that's a positive thing. The drivers are just both very happy with it, both Carlos Sainz and Charles Leclerc, which hasn't always been the case. Charles Leclerc compared the first day of running very favourably compared to last year, when you thought, oh, this is a bit all over the place, but they're both pretty happy now. So, yeah, I think Fred Vasseur has been very careful not to get too overexcited, but he was sort of very, very quietly positive. So, yeah, Ferrari best place to be the nearest challenger. But it's very interesting because Ferrari don't look head and shoulders above those also in that bustling group behind chasing Red Bull, but they do look just ahead. But picking out the others in that group, there's McLaren around there, Mercedes, Aston Martin, even RB, as some people have been suggesting. So, Samarth, do you want to have a stab at who might be
thanks for putting
third best, fourth best from what you've seen?
I'm on the spot, and it's only my second podcast with a race. I'm going to go for, that's a really tough one. Okay, here's the thing. I don't think we've seen much of Mercedes, and I think you're right. I don't think they've shown their hand, and that's making it quite difficult to judge.
I don't think they've got their hand arranged quite yet. Is the way I'd put it, but carry it in that they're still building understanding of the car. So similar thing, but I don't think they're hiding. I think they're working. Let's put it that way.
Which is why, if I'm not a betting man, because I'd lose a lot of money. But which kind of makes this next thing pointless. But basically, I will put McLaren up there behind them. They've had a solid-ish test. I know there have been a couple of gremlins, but on pace, they do look pretty solid. It's just because I haven't seen that much from Merck. And is that concerning at this point for them?
Well, it depends, because the drivers are both happier with the car, better rear stability. The team's happier with the platform mechanically that they've got, and they think they've got something they can work with. But it doesn't feel like they're completely on top of everything. They were still doing a lot of work. We'll talk to Gary Anderson later about what they were doing with the suspension, the front suspension, a bit more anti-dive on it today. So they're still working through things. So I feel like if you think of zeroing in on making these cars work and understanding them as sort of a big wide bar, and it narrows as running goes, I think Mercedes haven't narrowed that bar in as much as some others, because they've changed so much, which is why I say they haven't completely arranged their hand. So I don't think they're sort of deliberately hiding or anything. So I think your call on McLaren for third is perfectly legitimate. What do you think though, Scott? Because McLaren seem to be playing things down quite a bit, both publicly and privately. They're not shouting from the rooftops, but they do look pretty reasonable.
I think they're in a position to start the season in a strong place, and in a place that sort of better reflects their potential for the season. Whereas the last few years, even actually before this rule set, remember in 2021 as well, I don't feel like they really hit the ground running in testing, and they were working through some things there. And that doesn't mean that they're going to be second best and fighting for wins as soon as possible, which ultimately their ambition this year, they've said publicly they want to fight for wins this year. They want to win races if they can. And that's not a generic, oh, every team would love to win a race this year if they could. That's a sincere, that has to be our ambition.
And absolutely should be, given the progress they made last year.
Yeah, exactly. And again, in that context, you might think it's disappointing if they don't start as second best. But the way they see it is that that is a tight group. They want to be in that group to start with. They've got upgrades that they're really happy with that are progressing in the background. Couldn't be produced quite in time for the launch car. That doesn't mean that they've missed targets or anything. It just means some work that they've been doing, some really fruitful development work, just hasn't come off in time to add it to the launch spec. So they're confident about what they've got up their sleeve. They've made some progress with their weaker car characteristics from last year, but there's still work to do there. So when you bundle all of that together, what you have is a team that's certainly not in crisis. It's a car that's behaving relatively well and that the drivers seem to be quite happy with. It reflects some development from the end of last year. So they're in the mix, but what they're not, and I don't think they're necessarily expected to be, is necessarily immediately at the head of that best of the rest group. I think if they've got to have both cars in Q3, and I think they should have both cars in Q3, they've probably got to be fighting to have at least one car on the first three rows of the grid. I think they'd be disappointed if they didn't have one car in the top six on the grid. And I think they'd want to see in the race that they're strong enough to fight Ferrari and Mercedes. I think they'd be disappointed if they came out of Bahrain fifth best and only with a couple of lowly points finishes.
So we're sort of saying McLaren and Mercedes are third and fourth a bit interchangeably. We haven't quite worked out. We've still got some number crunching to do as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, it's a bit difficult because when you look at them on track, I think the Merc has slightly more eye-catching moments on track. But it also has moments that make you think this is taking a while to get into the working window that they want. And that's not similar to last year where it had a narrow working window. I think they're still figuring out this car. The Mercedes has changed a lot more than the McLaren from the end of last year. So that just stands to reason. But when I was watching trackside at the end of day three, the McLaren looked better at the end of its long run than the Aston Martin did. But it didn't look like a Ferrari. I didn't have a Mercedes in terms of the eye test long run to compare it to, so that's trickier to judge. But from what they've said, they're not at Ferrari's level. The question is, where does Merck fit in that? I think that's the big question for me. I think McLaren will be a little bit off Ferrari, and then it's about where that Merck is in reality, when that will be where it nudges in or slips in ahead of McLaren, or is fighting it or behind it.
And the thing is, it's all pretty small gaps at this stage, so very small swings are going to make all the difference. But I think that's given us kind of our top four as it is of now. It'll probably evolve as we do some more study in the coming days. But yeah, I think that's roughly where things are at. Now, before we delve into the rest of the field, it's time for a reminder of the incredible offer we're running right now for the Race Members Club. If you enjoy this podcast and want more audio content, as well as loads of other things like early access to our Bring Back V10s podcast and an ad-free web environment, then the Race Members Club could be for you. Right now, for a limited period, you can get a month's membership for free. And after that, the normal monthly price is just £2.99, which we hope you'll think is fantastic value. We've lots planned over the coming months, and there's plenty in the archive for you to dig into as well. And we'll have another Q&A podcast between now and the Bahrain Grand Prix weekend, especially for members. So to sign up today, click the link in the description to this episode.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Right, Samarth, we've kind of done our top four. We've briefly mentioned Aston Martin, who we do see as being in that group chasing Ferrari. But do you feel that they're towards the bottom of it, rather than nipping at the heels of Red Bull as they were at the start of last year?
Yeah, I'm not. I wonder if it's been. There was some optimism today from Fernando Alonso. I wonder if it's been that good a test for them. And I do think they'll find themselves fighting perhaps RB, who've been perhaps more optimistic after the test. I think they had a really solid test. Again, have Aston Martin not played their hand that much? I think there's a case of it. I think on long runs, they do look okay. I don't know where they stack up in that midfield, but I think they're going to be perhaps not at the same level as they were last year, which might be unfortunate for them.
It seems to be the car's working quite well and quite nicely and responding quite well, but Scott just maybe lacking that last tiny edge of pace. So maybe more getting into Q3 car than bothering the front row car, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think so. There was a bit of a feeling towards the end of day two and start of day three that one or two teams thought it might be on that on the back end of that group and bothering some of those teams. But I think you heard from Daniel Ricciardo directly, didn't you, Ed? And I had a bit of a chat with him just in the paddock, and he's very much like, we're not. He's kind of aware that some people are talking them up, but he's like, we're not there. He said something to me. I don't know if he said this in the media session, but he said something to me about they've got the impression, well, not got the impression, it basically was quite clearly hinted at the end of last year that there were some concerns that this team was going to rock up with a Red Bull copy of the Red Bull 2023 car.
Which they absolutely haven't.
They have not. And Ricciardo said, I think people expected us to have some kind of like pink Mercedes style racing point thing from 2020, and so it would just be the RB19 in new RB colors, because that that naming system isn't confusing at all, and therefore would be super competitive and out of the blocks. But no, they've gone in their own direction around the Red Bull parts that they have taken, and they've built on where they got to at the end of last year when this team had got to be in the fifth fastest car. I think it was the fifth fastest car. It's not going to be quite that again because it's got other teams, you know, like Aston should have re-established itself ahead of that team over the winter, for example. But they're in a good place to have got clear of that group behind, which is what I think they've done, to even just be like, comfortably is a dangerous word to use around any kind of ranking, but I think it is comfortably sixth best. I don't see it as a risk of the teams behind.
Probably not. It's difficult because the gaps are going to be so small.
So it comes down to execution.
Exactly. But I think if everyone's getting a notional 100% out of the car, yeah, I think that car is probably, it's on the fringe of Q3. I'm interested to see how it can do up against Aston Martin.
I think they'd be really happy if they got one car into Q3 and one or both cars in the points, even if they were 9th and 10th.
Yeah, yeah.
I guarantee that team would be satisfied with
that. Yeah, that'd be good. And Ricciardo, even talking on the record, he was quite optimistic about how they were doing. You know, he wasn't talking about, he was being asked about podiums and he's like, no, look, we're going nicely, but this is very much a continuation of what we were doing last year, and they've made some decent progress. So I think RB are looking pretty handy, and I think for them success this season would be leaving that back group behind. So yeah, we've kind of got them, yeah, the sixth best, and then biting at the heels maybe of Aston Martin perhaps. But again, all the numbers tell us these gaps are quite small, and it doesn't take much for a team to be 1/10 better than it looks and another to be 1/10 worse, and then suddenly everything swaps around. But yeah, I think Daniel Ricciardo looked and sounded and half said that he was quite confident they had left that rear group behind. So I feel like he's left it, they feel like they've left it behind, but they can't be completely confident they won't slip back into it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think that's fair, especially because when I was trackside in that final hour today, two of the most leery moments I saw came from Yuki Tsunoda when he was on, did he have both of them on the C3 or maybe one of them was on the C4? He had a monster lockup on one lap coming in, like proper left a ton of tire smoke hanging in the air. It was horrible because it stinks for starters, but it hangs for a little while. And then he did basically the same a lap later, but he just didn't lock up. He just ran really deep. And I just thought, is this the car performing less well when the fuel's come out of it and they've done a quali sim? Or is it just, you know, drivers out in the last sort of 30 minutes of the session, he's put the softest tires on, he's got a bit carried away, because drivers do that in testing. We see it, you ask a little bit too much of it, and as I've said a million times on these podcasts, that's why I go and watch at that corner, because it does just invite the driver to overreach slightly. But it was a little reminder that car didn't look perfect all the time, and it doesn't take much to overstep the limit, because that's the other thing. We don't know how much everybody's taken their cars to the limit. And it's very, very easy for a car to look nicely poised and balanced and actually a bit quite well together when it's being driven at 99%. And then when everyone turns everything up to 100, that's just where you see the cracks in the car's performance characteristics emerge.
Yeah, that's the big question. But yeah, I think we're fairly positive about RB's progress, and they seem pretty happy that they've taken a nice step from the back end of last year. So we're talking about the group at the back. There's kind of a group of four cars we've got as the notional at the back group. And it's very interesting because you can slice and dice it all sorts of ways about who's at the front of
rank them again.
Yeah. Who would you like to pick?
It's behind RB.
This is really tough. It's really tough because a lot of the language is about how much progress they've made from last year. And as soon as you ask anyone, they're like, I don't want to make that guess. So it's very difficult.
They also all claim that they're not looking at what the other teams are doing as well.
And so then the next answer is them saying that they are looking at it.
I'll tell you what I did appreciate today. You were there as well, Samarth. When Jody Egginson, the technical director at RB, such a difficult name, we were quizzing
almost
Pete Beyer, the CEO, earlier about that. He was gamely trying to justify the branding. But anyway, I won't go back down that particular route. But he was good because he was talking about other cars, not making bold comments about how quick they'll be, but he was good because he would talk about technical details they've spotted on other cars that were interesting. Because normally they say, "Oh, we don't pay attention to that," which they absolutely do because it's part of their job. I just like the fact that he was willing to talk about some other cars in general terms. But anyway, I've completely gone off on a tangent there.
Well, no, he was a breath of fresh air, actually. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, yeah. I completely agree with that. Sauber do look good. I wonder if they will be a bit up and down as they were last year, where you'll find it's a track-specific thing for them, whereas some tracks they'll be really good, some tracks they might not be so good. So I would place them possibly there, I think. Williams, I'm not sure. There were some procedural things and things that didn't go quite their way as well, which is a little bit concerning for them, but they did make a step up. Again, you know, the old cliche there, I just put it out. So, okay, I'm going to go for Sauber next.
P7?
Yeah.
Ooh, okay.
Oh, here we go.
So when Joe was in the car, wasn't he, at the end of the day? And when he came out on the C4, I think, that he did his fast lap on at the end?
I believe so.
He came through and it looked really good. And when you're out at turn 10, there's no leaderboard around, and I didn't have timing on me. It's quite nice in those moments to just focus on what you're seeing, because then you're just not like trying to convince yourself you're seeing a fast lap. So all I noted was that actually, to be honest, all day when I was watching there, like, the Sauber never looked bad. But Joe comes through in on the C4, and it did leave a that looks really tidy. That was the impression. It looked perfectly good, and that's easier to do when you put the C4 on. Then I got back, and the point I would make on that is it looked good as well. The only other reference it had at the time was Tsunoda, who had gone out on the RB and he'd screwed his lap up, and then or screwed a lap up that I saw, I should say, and then Russell as well. And Joe came through really not looking like tremendously worse than Russell looked when he came through. But I am fairly convinced, I think I'm quite confident in saying, I imagine that was a low fuel run from Joe, and that's where the lap time came from. So my suspicion is there is that flattered how the car looked and the lap time, and maybe not necessarily right now at the end of testing, but by the time we get back at the track next week, my suspicion is they will have slipped behind possibly both Williams and Alpine. But I don't have high hopes for Alpine.
Well, Alpine, they're a factory team, obviously, a works team. How worried are you about them, Samarth? They're not looking great yet, are they?
Quite, which is, I guess that was the logic I was using when I put Sauber ahead of them. It hasn't been a good test for them. It's been concerning in a couple of ways. They've got a lot of work to do, but they are a works team, so it would be baffling if they weren't seventh fastest.
I would say that it's a bit weird because I think they've had a really good test in terms of the way it's worked. I think they're still in a bit of a adjustment phase from all of their changes mid-season last year, and this was their first pre-season test under the new regime. And there's a lot of noise coming from that team about how well it's sort of working together and how productive the test has been, and they've got through everything they wanted to get through, and it's all been pretty smooth. But where the test hasn't been good is in the performance, and they'd already hinted at that in the launch. It was becoming pretty clear on day two that it was struggling. By day three, the team was openly playing it down and suggesting that they're going to have a difficult start and they're not going to be where they need to be. So they are, at the moment, I see no reason for them to be anywhere other than in this back four team group. And my gut feeling, by what we've heard and then also what we've seen at trackside, because it looks like the hardest work of any of the cars on the grid. I would put it, my gut feeling was to put it ninth. Like, that was my absolute gut feeling. But then I just, because of that whole, like, it's the Renault works team. Like, surely everything must be lying to me, and it must be a bit better than that. And I wouldn't be surprised if one car gets knocked out in Q1 next week, but if they're both on the back two rows of the grid, it would be an enormous letdown, regardless of the fact that they're trying to keep expectations in check. That would be a huge disappointment.
Yeah, it will be. Obviously, this is a team that's tried to change direction a bit. I'm gently encouraged, actually, by some of the stuff Bruno Famin, the team principal, saying about really taking a slightly different approach rather than having stupid targets for where they're going to be whenever, just trying to keep improving. So it's another one of those new starts for Alpine. That's the thing that's worrying. And we just have to hope that there's enough change there for this to be part of the process. But it's not looking great for the start of the season.
It is a weird kind of combination of things, isn't it? Like duality almost, because it is that there are, I do sincerely believe there are reasons to be optimistic about some things that we're seeing there and the attitude shift that there seems to be in terms of the absolute top level running of the team and how it's left to get on with stuff now, the structure that it's put in place, what Ed was saying there about the cultural changes and the way it's actually working. But that is currently taking place in the context of it being F1. If it is where we think it is, it's the most disappointing team at the start of the season.
Oh, certainly, because it's a factory team. It needs to be stronger than this. So they need to make progress. They do have upgrades planned for a few races in. But then again, so is everybody. So we need to see progress there. Not great for them to be in that back group. But again, front to back looks relatively condensed. So small gains relative to the rest can move you up. But yeah, not looking great. And that then brings us to Haas, who have a car that seems to work quite nicely. They seem to have worked quite well through their programme. So it's been a quietly efficient test for them, hasn't it?
Nico Hülkenberg was in another prickly mood today, by the way. I'm just going to say that.
Not entirely unusual. He likes a little bit of spikiness. He enjoys it.
Spiky. Well, he's got spiky hair. So, you know, he wears it on his head. And
sure, it's not on his floor, on his nose.
Ooh. Oh, here we go. I think no one's expecting them to be regular points contenders. No one is, not they aren't either. It's a transitional year in some senses. If they can kind of nail the platform, they've got something good to build on. And I think, I'm not going to say they've nailed it, but I think they've made good progress. I'll be very surprised to see one Haas get into Q2 though on Sunday. Oh, on Saturday. There we go, another one.
In fairness, the whole calendar's been ruined because it's about Saturday Grand Prix.
Yeah, so it's Saturday Grand Prix.
And so, yeah, it's actually on Friday. Well, obviously, qualifying was their strong point. So getting cars into Q2 should be like something that they should be aiming for. And then the aim should then be to maintain that position. You know, Aya Komatsu has said several times in this test that the main thing is they know from last year, what's the point of qualifying seventh if you go absolutely nowhere from them. But I'm interested in what you said about Hülkenberg, because I spoke to Magnussen today, and Magnussen's been in a really good mood this whole test, and he was nice and chatty. He's another one who can be quite difficult. Haas has a driver pairing that both drivers can be quite standoffish if they've got no interest in talking to you, but he's actually been pretty good this week, Kevin, and it was a good chat again today. He's like quite happy with how the test has gone, quite happy to have piled into the whole long run stuff and, you know, ignoring the low fuel runs a lot more. Pretty happy with the feeling that he has in the car and believes that there is an improvement on the tyre degradation stuff. So was it just Hulk's demeanour, or was he genuinely downbeat about things?
I think it's a demeanour thing. I think there is some optimism there, and I do think that they've solved some of those tyre issues. I don't think that the qualifying pace might remain this year, that's all. They did focus on long runs a lot in this test. I wonder if it means that they'll just be better on a Sunday, which is normally when races take place, and Saturdays might fall by the wayside a little bit more.
Well, I think they'd be willing to trade that, but there was an interesting thing that Komatsu said, actually, which I would imagine is the kind of process thing that you'd like, Ed. So they spent so long over days one and two getting the car in a good place, or where they felt was a good place for the race, and feeling like they were in a better place for tyre management and for race pace and whatever. And they got that set up and they feel like that's a good place for them to go into Bahrain next week. So then for their low fuel runs today, what they did is they basically made changes within the parameters that you can make within Parc Fermé. Because their intention is for this to effectively be their setup for next weekend, if they can, because they know that that seems to work at the moment for the best for the car over a long run and the race distance. And then they're going to fettle a qualifying setup from that, which I actually, like, okay, it means they could be vulnerable in qualifying against rivals that not only have done more qualifying work, but also are perhaps balancing their setup a bit more across qualifying and the race. But when you consider what their weakness is and how methodical they've been, I quite like that as an approach from Haas.
Yeah, it's sensible. It's just pragmatic, isn't it? Which is what they need to be. And I think the overall positive thing for Haas is with their approach and what they're doing and the car that seems to work quite well, they've got something they can go racing with, it seems. And that was the problem. They didn't have something they could go racing with very often last year. So that's the positive.
It occurs to me that by complete accident, dancing between these teams, we've mentioned Williams in passing a few times without actually saying anything in detail, but there's not a huge amount really to say in detail. It looks like a step. It looks like they've turned some weaknesses into strengths. They've got some other balance compromises that have come from that, but they seem to end the test in a much better place than their compromised first day. And yeah, I think they really could be at the front of that little 14 pack.
Certainly finishing seventh again in the coming year doesn't seem at all impossible.
It's quite a nice car. Like it looks nicely put together, but it also just seems to work really well on track. It doesn't seem to have any obvious vices anymore.
Yeah, which is good because it had quite a few vices last
yes, it
year.
Did. This track locking, really exposed them as well.
The front locking, the wind sensitivity, the instability. So relatively positive for Williams. But as we say, it's still pretty close. Small swings will make a difference. We'll get a lot more answers next weekend on the Bahrain Grand Prix, but we've at least got some idea. The competitive model of the season has started to take shape. We'll get back to the pod in a moment, but first, a word about our partner, Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done, and Grammarly can help. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at armorall.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Well, we've talked at length already about the relative performance of the cars, but we're now joined by Gary Anderson, who's done his own very interesting analysis based on a different methodology, but equally valid, and doesn't tell a dramatically different story, but does tell an interesting story in a slightly different way. So it's a very good way to have a look at the pace, obviously, in testing. It's all about trying to paint the picture of the competitive order. So, Gary, you've been number crunching. You've been frantically working on your Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah.
What have you learned?
Well, you know, the thing is, there's so many variables during testing. And obviously the teams keep their run programs to themselves. So we're never really au fait with all of that. All you can do is keep an eye for new tires appearing in the car. And a sudden switch in lap time that says, you know, something more going on here than just the tires. Because normally, you know, from a used set of tires to a new set of tires, you might see a second a lap or something. But whenever you sort of see 2 or 3 seconds, you know that they're getting a bit excited about life and trying to go for lap time. So what I've done is really take the laps. The majority of drivers did their time on the C3 tire, which is the medium tire, which I think is quite sensible because that's, you know, get the car working on that, and then either side of that, you know, the tire's a little bit softer, a little bit harder.
So the C3 is also the soft to the Bahrain Grand Prix weekend as well.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Useful reference.
It is the tire for the Bahrain weekend, but as in normal, as the medium compound at most places, but it ends up being the soft in Bahrain. And the reason they have the different tire choices is basically, you know, the tire durability for a lap. You know, really the you know, the C4 tyre load gives you a bit more lap time. You've got to drive it fairly carefully just to make sure it lasts to the end of the lap. There is more time in it, but you've got to be a bit cautious with it, really. So I think, you know, in reality, I think Pirelli said there was something like 0.8 of a second difference. I never quite agree with Pirelli on that sort of stuff.
It's all right. The teams generally disagree with Pirelli's deltas as well.
You know, they're huge. And in a theoretical world, yes, fine. But you've got to make sure that the tyre lasts for the whole lap. So I work on that. My analysis is, I think around Bahrain, if you look after the tyre nicely, you might gain 0.5 of a second a lap from a C3 to a C4. If you use a C5, which nobody really did in earnest, from a C3 to a C5, I think you might get 0.8, because, you know, the C5 helps a lot in traction, but the tyres will be just hanging on the rims by the end of the lap, so you don't get as much out of it. And again, the other way around, from C3 to the harder C2, you know, it's about 0.5 a second. And then C3 to the C1 is a bit more, about a second, because it's a very durable tyre. It hangs on to the end of the lap, but you lose a bit of traction. So in general, the C3 tyre, in my book, is a nice tyre to sort of do your development work on. It's Mr. Average. It's Mr. Average for across the range of circuits and whatever. So, as I say, the majority of teams did the running on the C3, so it's only fair to put a bit of time onto the people who use C4s, because it's only, you know, four or five drivers, half a dozen drivers, as opposed to, you know, the other 14 or whatever was left that used a C3. So my analysis and my numbers, I've done all to suit that.
And what do the numbers tell you? Because it's an interesting slight shuffle of the order, which maybe gives some good reason for excitement.
Yeah, it does give good reason for excitement. I mean, again, it's the same old deal. There is so many other things that can affect it, time of day. You know, as I say, fuel loads, 10 kilograms is 0.3 of a second. So there's lots of things, but we can only analyze it based on the information that we can see. And as I say, the only thing we really do know is the tires. So, you know, I get Ferrari still fastest. Carlos Sainz at 1:30.421. Because of adding on that time, because he did his fastest time of 29.9 on the C4. It still ends up fastest. The Ferrari still ends up fastest because of that time. Charles Leclerc, did a 1:30.8. Again, he used the C4 tyres, so there's, you know, 0.5 a second added on there. He ends up fifth overall. So, you know, Ferrari are in the ballpark. The car looked good. Both drivers were able to do, you know, a respectable job each time. The long runs looked pretty decent. So in general, I think they went through a good program and came out the other end of it. I think they'll be fairly happy. I think everybody's still waiting with bated breath to see what the Red Bull will do when push comes to shove, because it's never, you never quite know with them, you know. I think that when Ferrari are doing that sort of lap time, there's still a bit of fuel in the car. Last year's pole position, I think it was a 29.7. So it's, you know, not far away. We should see the cars being, you know, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 tenths of a second quicker than last year in reality. So, you know, you're looking at them, at maybe, you know, Ferrari looking at a second there, which is, as I say, is equivalent to like 30 kilograms of fuel. And I suppose that's not, you know, not out of bounds that's what they had, and the engine turned up a little bit more, and so on and so forth. But I get Red Bull second again, courtesy of Sergio Perez's time. Again, he did his time on the C4. You know, Max Verstappen went through more race preparation than actually going out and looking for a lap time. So I think there's a bit in there still. The fastest Red Bull was a 1:30.684. And Max was a 0.1 of a second sort of slower than Sergio. We sort of know that's not really fact, because it's not the way it works usually. I think Red Bull have got a little bit more to give than Ferrari, but I do think it might be nip and tuck between the two of them.
And it's in qualifying, perhaps, as last year.
Yeah, I don't think the Red Bull really focused so much on qualifying. Again, as Max has run here in the test, I think they, you know, they do focus on the race. They know they'll be in there in the ballpark in qualifying, all things being equal. And if they can do that, they know they can race well. So, you know, it's the first race of the year coming up. So we're all we're all waiting with bated breath to see what really does unfold, because we want, it's not necessarily I don't want Red Bull to win. I want them to have a harder time winning, at least. And that would just be great for me.
The Mercedes suspension was catching the eye both at front and rear today. Obviously, the rear suspension, nothing new, but there's something interesting that's been there right from the start when we first saw that suspension configuration, and then also something that changed on the Mercedes. So I think that's worth talking about. Do you want to have a chat about your concerns about the rear suspension first?
Well, the rear is one of these things where, you know, obviously Red Bull set about 2 years ago and went to push rod away from the pull rod. And the one view I've got of the Red Bull inboard suspension on the rear of the car, it's quite a different solution that they've got there as well. You know, the way they package it is pretty different from normal. Whereas getting a bit of a picture today of the Mercedes, the way they run their rocker and the torsion bar is very, it's a very basic way of doing it. It's very standard, where you just have a rocker at the top of the torsion bar. The bottom of the torsion bar is anchored in the bell housing of the car as such. The rocker rotates and the push rod pushes it. And there's nothing too exciting about it, I suppose you might call it. But, you know, the thing for me is that the push rod angle is very, 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 very shallow. And, you know, the shallower the angle, the higher the loads, because obviously, you know, you can't move the push rod as far with the vertical movement of the wheel. So you've got to then do the rocker ratio. You've got to make the rocker very, very small just to get the ratio and to rotate the torsion bar.
And that's just a pure mechanical thing, isn't it? A mechanical energy required.
Yeah. It's just the mechanical energy required to rotate that torsion bar from a vertical wheel movement. You've got to turn it into a rotation at the torsion bar. And sort of it's a balancing act between rotating a torsion bar too far and overstressing it, or, you know, not being able to rotate it enough, and you need a huge diameter torsion bar to give you the stiffness. So it's one of those sort of situations where I'm not sure that the Mercedes package's rear suspension is actually as optimal as the Red Bull one. The front suspension was slightly different, what we saw today. You know, this controlling the platform, as we call it, is now the big thing, because the cars are running so close to the ground, because they're ground effect cars, producing so much downforce from underneath the car that, you know, it's no good having the car working really well at one fixed ride height like you have in the wind tunnel, because the wind tunnel and CFD is steady state. You know, you go through a different ride height range, but each ride height you put the car to is a fixed ride height, and you get a set of numbers. You move it to a different ride height, you get a set of numbers, and then you try and extrapolate between the two to see what might have happened or what you think might happen. Still a lot of guesswork in it. And there's a lot of simulation tools that you can end up using to sort of do that and get the best out of it you can. But still, it's going from A to B to C to D of fixed points and then trying to draw a line between them. And in reality then, so you get your aero profile, and you need to make sure that aero profile is managed, is controlled. And the only way you can do that is with the suspension. Now, you can make the car solid and say, that's it. We'll put it at a fixed ride height, but the tire's still this rubber spring that's there. So you've got to accommodate that as well. So the teams have moved to, on the front of the car, a lot of anti-dive. In other words, when you have the weight transfer going onto the front axle during braking, the front of the car doesn't just smash itself into the ground, and you don't have to run stupidly stiff springs, because you take it out in the kinematics of the suspension. On the rear of the car, you're taking, you know, the weight transfer means it's coming from somewhere and going somewhere. So you're taking, you know, that's 6G, you're taking probably 300 kilograms of weight off the rear axle and sticking it on the front for a tenth, 2/10 of a second. It's diminishing as the car slows down and you're trying to get off the brake pedal. You know, you start off at 6G and you've got about 100 meters to stop. So it's going from 6G down to probably 1G by the time you turn in, down a slope. So the thing is, you want to keep the front of the car from smashing itself into the ground, and you want to keep the rear of the car from rising up, because that 300 kilograms you're taking off the rear and putting on the front. So the kinematics of the suspension, front anti-dive, rear anti-lift, that's all about that, basically, so you don't have to run Stuart Springs to control it. And Mercedes today were experimenting with the amount of anti-dive they have in the front of the car. Anti-dive is a funny thing because, you know, you can make it work for quite a high degree of anti-drive in the front of the car, but you'll get to a point where the driver's not getting any feedback because the car's not, theoretically, the car's not moving. It's all going through the suspension linkage, all the forces. So he's getting no feeling of the car movement, and it's very easy to lock the brakes. And we saw that with George Russell on a couple of occasions. I'm not saying it was that, but the amount of anti-dive they've got on the front of the car now is a lot. I personally believe that less is better, and I think the rear would be what I'd be concentrating on, stopping the rear coming up, because that gives you more downforce because you're keeping the car lower. On the front, you're just supporting the car from banging into the ground. But we'll see. You know, be interesting to see what they arrive with next weekend.
Well, it certainly shows that the suspension is a important technical battleground these days again, having been relegated behind the great god aerodynamics for quite a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's still there. It's there now. It's more important than people thought a long time ago, but it is to control the aerodynamics. So don't get me wrong. The suspension itself and the geometry isn't the be-all and end-all. Although I do say, and I will say, and I have said many, many times, that those black bits of rubber that you got on the ground are your best friend, and your suspension geometry can look after them, and a lot of teams don't. So, you know, you should pay a little bit of attention to the suspension geometry and the kinematics, because, as I say, without your best friend working with you, you're wasting your time.
Absolutely. Well, it's going to be a fascinating technical battle this year. Thanks very much for your coverage over the last few days, Gary. Loads on the website and then our previous podcast, and I'm sure we'll hear from you soon. Well, that's it for our 3 days of testing coverage from Bahrain. Head to therace.com for lots more analysis and to sign up for that Members Club offer we mentioned earlier. With the first race of the season just a week away, we'll be back with you very soon with everything you need to know about the 2024 F1 season.
The Athletic.